passage from Matthew's Gospel this evening. So can you please open your Bibles at Matthew chapter 15? And I'm going to read from verse 21, Matthew 15, 21. Then Jesus went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed." But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she cries out after us." But he answered and said, "I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Then she came and worshipped him, saying, "Lord, help me." But he answered and said, "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." And she said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from the master's table." Then Jesus answered and said to her, "O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire." And her daughter was healed from that very hour. Jesus then departed from there, skirted the Sea of Galilee, and went to the mountain and sat down there. A great multitude came to him, having with them the lame, blind, mute, maimed, and many others. And they lay down at Jesus' feet and he healed them. So the multitude marveled when they saw the mute speaking and the maimed made whole and the lame walking and the blind seeing. And they glorified the house of Israel. What is the context for this story? In the previous two chapters, or in the previous few days or weeks at the most, John the Baptist had been executed. Jesus had given lots of parables. And then finally, he'd gone away to the wilderness in the east of the Sea of Galilee in order to spend some time alone with God. But the multitudes had followed him out into the wilderness, and he had fed the 5,000. The very first time I went to Israel, it was to see a friend of mine called Ian Stanfield, who had started a ministry amongst the Israeli Defense Force. And these messianics within the Israeli army were having a camp on the east of Galilee, on the very field where many think that Jesus preached the feeding of the 5,000, and it was quite an experience doing it. You had a natural amphitheater, and Jesus had gone up, spent some time with God, his Father, came down with some revelation. And then he'd fed the 5,000. And then he left them all and they went back by boat. And there was a great storm. And Jesus came walking over the water and he calmed the storm. Now, if you go up a mountain to receive revelation from God, and then you feed Israel in the middle of a wilderness, and then you control the wind and the waves, who does that remind you of? Who did things like that? Jesus, I believe, is claiming specifically to be the prophet like Moses in this passage. Going up to the top of the mountain, preaching to people in the wilderness without food, just like providing manna. And then going out into the sea, and whereas Moses parted the waves and people went safely through, instead of parting the waves, Jesus goes over them and still controls them. I think Jesus is specifically claiming to be the prophet like Moses. The other thing I think of in the passage before this story that I'm going to relate tonight is that, there's a feeding of the 5,000 men plus women and children. That could be 15, 20,000 people. I mean, when was the last time that you ever met 15,000 Jews who went anywhere and all forgot their lunch? Apart from one boy with a handful of fish and bread. There's two ways of looking at it. Either Jesus went further and longer than they expected, or maybe they actually deliberately went out there without their grub, wondering, this Jesus is claiming to be the prophet like Moses. Is he going to prove that he is by feeding us in the middle of a wilderness? I'm sure that not 15,000 people think alike, but 15,000 Jews going into the wilderness, that's 5,000 men, probably the same number of women and children. I mean, all those people going out without lunch. I mean, some of them, I'm sure it was accidental, but maybe some of them decided not to bring their lunch and see if Jesus would actually feed them, whether he was actually the prophet like Moses. But those three together, going up a mountain and spending time alone with God, coming down, meeting his disciples, just like Moses met with his immediate followers, people like Aaron and Joshua, and then feeding the multitudes in the wilderness and parting the waves and controlling the sea. I mean, it's very Moses-like, isn't it? Jesus is claiming to be the prophet like Moses, which is a major messianic theme. Afterwards, he gets into a discussion with the rabbis. Some religious authorities argue with him at the beginning of 15. And despite of what Jesus has done, they have this very pedantic argument about the fact that his disciples don't wash their hands properly. You know, talking about majoring on minors. And this kind of, well, I suppose that it must be despairing in its context. And Jesus doesn't accept their criticism. Instead, he says, well, rely on what matters. Don't be religious in your spirit, but be spiritual in your spirit. Focus on what really matters. He points out the fact that people were even using tithing in order to neglect their parents. Where he said, well, what really matters at the end of the passage is, I mean, what really matters is that out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornication, theft, foolishness, blasphemy. The things which defile a man come out, they don't come in. It's not washing with unwashed hand that defile a man. It's what comes out of the tongue and what comes out of the heart. However, all of this, the argument with the religious authorities and the time before where Jesus proves that he's a prophet like Moses, is a heck of a lot of activity. It certainly would exhaust a regular person. And Jesus, even though he is divine, is living his 33 years with the limitations of humanity as well. And so what he does is he takes another break and he goes out to Tyre and Sidon. Jesus went out from there and he departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. Why did he go to Tyre and Sidon? Not where he went for a break last time, but people followed him on the east side of the Galilee, but going up the northwest into modern Lebanon. Why did he go to Tyre and Sidon? Well, it's a Gentile area. And because he's not really known that much outside Israel, Maybe he can get some peace. Maybe if he goes to Tyre and Sidon, unlike going to the east coast of the Galilee, he's not going to be followed by a multitude. He's going to have a break. However, the good thing about going to Tyre and Sidon, as far as surrounding yourself with a predominantly Gentile field, is that they are the friendliest Gentiles around you. If you go south from Israel at the time of Jesus, you go into Egypt. If you go east, you go to Jordan. If you go northwest, you go into Syria, where the Babylonians, the Assyrians, where the descendants of Ishmael, where the Egyptians are, people who still have a grudge with you. But people in Tyre and Sidon were the friendliest Gentiles out there. I mean, after all, Tyre and Sidon had actually helped the Jewish people build the temple at the time of Solomon. They would have had some understanding of Judaism, of at least how the temple worked, because their descendants had actually provided the materials for it. And they were generally more friendly than other people who had a history on the other sides of, you know, whether you went instead of northwest, if you went northeast, if you went east, if you went south, you can go west, you hit the Mediterranean. All of Israel's other neighbors had either been conquered by the Jews or had conquered the Jews and had some kind of historical grudge. It very much is similar to modern times. Even up to the Six-Day War, even up to 1973, the Yom Kippur War, Israel was fairly friendly to Lebanon. It had a Christian majority. If anything, it would have stayed out of the war or be friendly to Israel. Unfortunately, the Lebanese accepted Palestinian Muslim refugees. They outnumbered them. They took them over. And now you have Arab Muslim fanatics controlling Lebanon. And Lebanon is no longer a safe place for an Israeli to go, unlike before 1975. But in these times, Tyre and Sidon was a fairly safe place to go, friendliest of the Gentile neighbors. And they even had some understanding of what was going on. And there was, behold, a woman of Canaan from the region who had actually heard, even though she was a foreigner in a strange place, this woman in Tyre and Sidon had actually heard of Jesus's ministry. The fact that he cast out demons, the fact that he healed the sick, the fact that he was capable of doing the miraculous. And this woman hears that Jesus is around, taking a break in Tyre and Sidon, and he approaches him. And behold, a woman of Canaan comes from the region, and she follows him and cries out to him, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David." She even has a theological understanding of who she is, that Jesus is actually the Son of David, a divine descendant of a previous Jewish king, the one before the one who ordered the timber from Lebanon that built the temple. "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely demon possessed. A demon has attacked and taken over my daughter. Please cast out the demon. Please protect her. Please heal her." And Jesus is initially silent. And the question I want to ask at this point in the story is Jesus's silence because he's basically ignoring her? I mean, basically, this is a Gentile woman. He's none of her business. Is he intending to do nothing about the woman's predicament? It's certainly what the disciples think. He answers as not a word, and his disciples come up and urge him, "Send her away, she cries out after." I mean, you're supposed to take a rest here. Isn't she allowed distraction? I mean, give us permission or tell her yourself to go. It isn't the first and only time when Jesus is taking a rest from public ministry that Jesus does something like this. He does something similar with Jewish children later on. Oh, tell the children to be at a distance. But Jesus ministers to the children, just like Jesus is going to minister to this woman. But I find the way that he ministers to her, although I think he intended to do something all along, is indeed somewhat curious. He doesn't do the parallel with the Jewish children, which is basically, oh, don't call them away. I've come to minister to children as well as adults. And then he starts to discuss with them. He interacts with them. He relates to them. What does he say next? I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Is he rejecting her approach for help? Well, you're not part of the lost sheep of the house of Israel, are you? I mean, you're Lebanese, you're Canaanite, you come from Tyre and Sidon. I mean, you're not a lost sheep of Israel. I mean, you may be some kind of lost sheep, but certainly not one from Israel. I'm taking a rest, don't bother me. And instead, she comes and worships him. I mean, if someone said to me, you're not within my catchment area, you're not my business, I might shrug my shoulders and walk off. But what is her response to this apparent delay or retort? She already knows that he's a son of David. She might even suspect, on the basis of his recent history, which is clearly drifted back to her, that he is either a candidate for or he is the prophet like Moses. She comes and worships him, probably lying down on the ground or at least kneeling. And she says, Lord, help me. Does Jesus respond to this call for help by saying, well, actually, you are part of my constituency. I'll make you my business. No, he seems to reject further. It's not good to take the bread from the children and throw it to the little dogs. And this implies, surely, on face value, that Jesus is saying that the woman from Tyre and Sidon is not like one of the Jewish children who the disciples falsely tried to keep at a distance, whereas Jesus wanted to embrace and minister them. She really is not his business. I mean, she's a little woof, not a child. However, she is so persistent. And she says, yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Okay, if you say I'm a dog rather than a sheep, I'm a dog rather than a sheep. Frankly, I don't know what's better, being a dog or a sheep. They both seem to have problems to me, but then I'm a cat lover. However, okay, I'm a dog rather than a sheep, but even the dogs eat the crumbs from the master's table. For you in your greatness, it's a small thing to do what I'm asking you to do. Please heal and deliver my daughter. And what he does then is at the end is Jesus answers and says to her, "O woman, great is your faith." Suddenly, there is a compliment. "Let it be as you desire." And her daughter was healed of her affliction in perfect health, and also delivered from the demonization at that very point. I find during this COVID period of time, as life becomes extremely inconvenient to so many people, and I know I've shared this at the Monday meetings, I see a polarization in people around me. Most people during the COVID era, as life has become more complicated and difficult, have really resented God for allowing this. "How dare you allow this, God? I thought you were in charge. Things are bad and they're getting worse. My life is getting harder. I have to decide food or fuel. It gets more complicated to do everything. Get your act together." What I really think this does, because it echoes a lack of trust through that implicit hostility, what it really does is show subconsciously the attitude of a fallen man or woman. And most people are fallen and not redeemed. Believers are a minority, as we know, and getting a smaller one. When life gets tough, people's subconscious hostility towards and rejection of God becomes more overt. The hostility builds up, and the hostility builds up against God's chosen people. And I think this subconscious hostility towards God shows itself both in a universal rise of anti-Semitism and also persecution of the body as well. I read a paper by Christian Solidarity Worldwide the other day. Do you know that now 70% of the world's evangelical Christians live in countries where they're persecuted? We're in the fortunate third. And even when countries where believers aren't persecuted, do you think life is easier for us or harder for us than 10 years ago? Do you think we're more or less popular? Answer, we are less popular. We're enraging the wokes. We're going to get in trouble, aren't we? Life is becoming difficult for us because of our stand for sexual morality, against gay marriage, against abortion, against pornography. Life will get harder and harder for us. And so I see in the COVID era, most people becoming more subconsciously hostile towards God, more divorced from him. And they show that in a rise in anti-Semitism and persecution of Christians in 70% of the cases. And the fact that Christians aren't exactly the most popular people in the world in the other 30% of Christians' lives. But I do see the most desperate people occasionally, instead of showing their subconscious hostility towards God, I see the most desperate people, when their face is against the wall, actually break down and cry out to God for help. And I see the most unlikely people coming through to be saved. Just like this woman from Tyre and Sidon. You wouldn't expect a woman from Tyre and Sidon to be saved like this, would you? Or to have her daughter delivered and in perfect health. But people in their most desperate states pour through to faith. And she does. And why do I think that when she approaches Jesus, Jesus doesn't initially accept her and say, "Thank you for coming to me. Yes, I will heal your daughter. I'm glad you recognize who I am. Of course I'll heal your daughter." I think sometimes as we approach God, instead of making life easy for us and being superficial with the easiness and just filling lots of tick boxes, if what we're asking for is hard, and in her case, it's being the first disciple of Jesus, the first saved person, the first believer within her entire subculture. Sometimes if we ask God for something difficult, rather than give us easy boxes to tick, I think God says to us, "Well, this is going to be hard for you. You're asking for something difficult. Do you really want it? Is this what you really want? Have you really counted the cost? Are you really prepared for this? Are you sure about this?" And I think that's parallel with the game that Jesus is playing. I believe that he did intend to heal her all along. I think that healing is universally within Jesus's heart. After all, he came to earth in order to destroy the fruit of the fall. He came here to destroy sin, sickness, and death. So he wants health. And he wants life. And he wants righteousness. But he's not making it easy for her, because he wants to appropriately respond in serious gravitas to the serious request that she's making. I come from a pagan society, even though they're the Gentiles who are most sympathetic towards our Jewish neighbors. No one amongst my friends and relatives follows a Jewish rabbi. But I believe this one is the prophet like Moses. I think this one is special. I think this one can kick the demon out of my daughter and heal her. And I'm going to follow him. Even though it will be unpopular, even though people are going to consider it's weird when I don't trot out and do the pagan things at the local tree next Sunday. Jesus knows that she's asking for something which will have serious consequences within her life. Yes, if he fulfills her request, the daughter will be healed. The daughter will be delivered. But the mother's going to be the only disciple of Jesus within her world. And that's going to lead to a cost of isolation, considered weird, unpopular. Do you really want it? Do you really want it? Do you really want it? I'm not going to give it to you straight away. I'm going to make you count the cost. I'm going to make you question whether you really want it before I deliver it to you. And I think that's Jesus's game here. Jesus says, "I've come to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Well, instead of a lost sheep, you're going to be a lost dog, aren't you? You're going to be the first dog following me rather than the first sheep. You're going to be isolated within your world. You're going to be considered a one-off. Oh, so you're willing to still accept the crumbs from my table. Okay, you know, I've challenged you with the seriousness of your request and you've accepted it. Well, I'm going to give you more than crumbs from my table. I will heal your daughter, and I will deliver her from her affliction. O woman, you have great faith. Must be scandalous in front of your neighbours to be worshipping a Jewish rabbi, taking a break in the middle of the Tyrian peninsula. Must be, can you, I mean, there you are worshipping a Jewish rabbi when you should be following pagan gods. You're really sticking your neck out. Oh, you have great faith. You've counted the cost. I know you're willing to follow it. O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire. And of course, the daughter is then healed and delivered. As I said, at this point in time, I think most people's subconscious hostility towards the God of Israel is drifting out. And we're seeing it in a rise of anti-Semitism and unpopularity of believers within the societies in which they live. But the most desperate people are reaching out, and they're finding the real God, and they're finding the real Jesus, and they're being saved, and they're being delivered, and they're being healed. And this woman is a prototype of such. After this healing, Jesus departed, skirts around the Sea of Galilee, and goes back. He goes out to the southwest of Galilee, Galilee of the Gentiles, which is Greek speaking. I'd like to say at this point that 40% of people in Galilee at the time of Jesus were not Jewish, they were Greek migrants. And because they were the wealthiest 40%, Jewish people such as Jewish fishermen and Jewish carpenters had to learn Greek in order to do business with the Greeks, otherwise they couldn't make ends meet. F.F. Bruce once said that a Jewish boy in the Galilee would have as good Greek as a Welsh boy in Cardiff would have English. When we're actually reading the New Testament in Greek, we're actually reading Jesus's original words. We don't actually have to translate it into Hebrew. You've actually got his original words. Greek would have been the public language of Galilee. Nevertheless, Jesus goes out in that part of the Galilee, the Decapolis, and the multitudes follow him just like they did on the other side of the ocean. And Jesus does more of the same. First of all, we see him healing the lame, the blind, the mute, and the maimed. And then there's still a feeding 5,000 people. He goes and feeds 4,000 people. That's just the men. As I said, with the women and children, you could triple the number, maybe more like 12,000, like the 5,000 was more like 15,000. But that's a heck of a lot of people. That's a real public ministry. Jesus goes back to saying, I can feed you in the middle of the wilderness. I can give you your needs. I can heal your sick. I can provide for you. I'm the prophet like Moses. I'm the son of David. He builds his profile and his public ministry develops. And now, retrospectively, nearly 2,000 years later, we know after his triumphant resurrection and triumph over sin and death and sickness, that Jesus truly is the son of David, that he truly is the prophet like Moses. But I want to thank him for this woman from Tyre, one of the prototype Gentile believers who were grafted into the olive tree. And I'm so glad that you Gentiles are grafted in. Otherwise, first of all, this meeting would be much smaller. And secondly, I wouldn't have married my Ruth. Marry. Thank you very much for listening to me. I'm just going to close in prayer. Lord, we thank you for the fact that you healed this woman's daughter, that you delivered her. And I pray that your healing and deliverance may come today. I pray that at serious times we may count the cost, be serious rather than superficial in our calculations, but still decide to follow you and do it your way and have you on the throne of our life. And I pray that we may stand up for you. I pray that we may support the desperate people who come through to you, but also pray that we may stand up for you as becoming a believer in our society becomes yet more unpopular. I pray that we may stand for you because you have more than stood for us. You were put on a cross for us. So the least we can do is stand for you. Amen. Thank you.